not letting fear win. You know, that's what I feel people who do these types of things would want you to do, to run inside and hide. And ultimately, if you do those things, it's letting them win. I know that my friends that we lost wouldn't want that.
Jasmine Warner, a resident of Colorado Springs, speaking at a community vigil there yesterday. She says she was friends with some of the victims who died Saturday at the LGBTQ bar Club Q after a gunman burst in, killing 5 people and injuring 18 others. The suspect is expected to face murder and hate crime charges, according to court records, but no formal charges have been filed yet. Suspect has a history with law enforcement, which includes making a bomb threat back in 2021. We're going to learn more about who the victims were in a moment. But first, let's get the latest on what we've learned about what led up to Saturday's shooting. Abbanay Clayton is the lead reporter for a project at The Guardian called Guns and Lies in America. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so the suspect, 22 years old, has had already a history with law enforcement. He apparently threatened his mother with a bomb. He said he had a bomb, and this was in June of 2021. Tell us more about that incident.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, in June of 2021, his mother alerted law enforcement that he had threatened to bomb the home with her inside and with a homemade bomb. So she called police officers. A bomb squad ended up coming. They had to evacuate folks. They determined that there wasn't a firearm, but reports say that his mother mentioned that he does have firearms and ammunition. There was an original criminal complaint, I believe, filed, but there's no indication that there was any convictions for the threat against his mother, or any sort of domestic violence charges. So that's really all we know, is that this incident happened. You know, police were called. It seems quite serious if an evacuation was ordered, but things mm-hmm. start to get a little more opaque when you talk about convictions and, of course, you know, removal of guns after.
Right. However, Colorado does have a red flag law, and that allows guns to be removed from people deemed dangerous to themselves or others. So how is that supposed to work in cases like this, where there was a bomb threat made and the suspect has guns?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, in the ideal implementation, a family member, a police officer, I believe in Colorado's case, even a concerned neighbor, teacher, something like that, can petition a court for a what's called an extreme risk protection order. And the basis would be, you know, a credible threat, a history of threats, a history of domestic violence. There's quite a range of circumstances under which someone would file this sort of petition. And in the case of the 22-year-old suspected shooter out of Colorado Springs, you know, a police officer or a sheriff's deputy would theoretically be empowered to petition a court, even if the family member was uncooperative, and pursue a, like I mentioned, an extreme risk protection order. It's also called an ERPA, you know, because it's quite the mouthful. But mm-hmm. if it is accepted by a county judge, these things are implemented locally. So it would have to be, you know, petitioned by someone by a resident, and then a local judge would accept it. And there are increments of time that somebody's guns would be taken from them. And I think it begins at 2 weeks and then can increase by 6 months. Some mm-hmm. people have their guns taken from them, or they're barred from buying them for up to a year. It's a civil procedure, so it's not like you're going to have a felony or a criminal complaint on your record. But in Colorado's case, it is supposed to be a tool that people can use when they see someone who can be a possible risk to themselves or someone else, whether or not they mm-hmm. have a firearm, or there's already been a mm-hmm. criminal conviction.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know if this was pursued at all in this case.
No, we don't. Unfortunately, that's another opaque bit that there's right. been much speculation about.
Meanwhile, Colorado Springs is in El Paso County in Colorado, which has declared itself a Second Amendment sanctuary. So mm-hmm. how does that complicate using the red flag laws?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, just a little bit of background there. This county, El Paso County, first designated itself as a Second Amendment preservation county is the kind of exact language that they used. And it became a resolution in 2019 when it was clear that the governor was going to sign their red flag bill, also called the Violence Prevention Act. And it was named after a sheriff's deputy who was shot and killed by somebody who theoretically should have had an ERPA put out on him. So that a little bit of background there. And what it does, it doesn't necessarily mean that people who live in the unincorporated areas of the county are exempt from any gun laws. It doesn't mean they don't have to follow state gun laws. And it also doesn't mean that they don't have access to ERPA petitions. It doesn't mean that they are disallowed from using the red flag bill. However, it does say that the county, the Board of Commissioners, won't put any money, won't put any, you know, sheriff's power behind implementing gun violence or extreme risk protection orders.
Right.
And yeah,
so it might give it also an indication then of the state of mind of many residents or officials in that county. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was nice to be on.
That's Abinay Clayton, lead reporter for The Guardian's Guns and Lies in America Project. Colorado Springs police released the identities of the five victims killed at Club Q on Saturday. Two of them worked behind the bar at the club. Another was a mother to an 11-year-old daughter. Here to tell us more about the victims is LA Times reporter Kevin Rector, who's in Colorado Springs covering this. And Kevin, I understand there is a growing memorial outside Club Q now. Can you describe it for us?
Yeah, people have been showing up to show their respects to those who were killed and those who were injured, and also to the club itself, which many describe as a safe space for the LGBTQ community here in Colorado Springs. There's a deep sense of loss and mourning, not only again for those who were lost, the five who were killed and the people who were wounded, but the shattering of that safe space for many people who don't have many spaces like that here in Colorado Springs, which in many ways is conservative and has at times made LGBTQ people feel ostracized.
Right. I've read that this was considered an island, the only place really in Colorado Springs where many people felt safe and welcomed.
Yeah. And I think in a town where there are not that many LGBTQ designated spaces, the ones that do exist become more important to members of the community. I am gay myself and have had sentiments about LGBTQ establishments being important and vital. And it's clear that many people here felt the same way about Club Q.
Yeah. So you spoke to family and friends of the five people killed. And I want to begin with 38-year-old Derek Rump. He was a bartender at Club Q. And tell us more about him.
Yeah, I have talked to friends of Derek's who described him as funny and hilarious, welcoming. And there is a tremendous sense of loss for Derek and his fellow bartender, Daniel, both of whom were part of what made Club Q welcoming and made people feel that they can be themselves there.
Daniel, it was the other bartender who I understand was a trans man.
Yes. Daniel, who was 28 years old, was a transgender bartender, beloved by people in the community for being himself and making others feel like they could be themselves. I talked to one person who said that when it was her first time out, at at the club. She was super nervous, and Daniel came up to her and said, "Seems like it's your first time. Let's get you a drink." Made her feel comfortable and like she belonged at Club Q. And she and others told me that Daniel had that presence for a lot of people.
There was also another young man there who was just 22 years old, Raymond Green Vance. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Raymond was at Club Q with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's parents. Last night, I spoke with Vance's girlfriend, Cassie's father, Mr. Fierro, and he was one of two people at the club who intervened and took down the shooter and held him down until police got there. Mr. Fierro described Raymond as a beautiful person. They got along and talked about football together, and he thought Raymond was a great guy for his daughter. And they were all there having a great time as a family. When the shooting erupted, Mr. Fierro said he went into combat mode. He's a U.S. Army veteran. And Mr. Fierro told me that he wanted to save everyone there in the bar, but unfortunately couldn't do so for five folks who were killed, including his daughter's boyfriend.
Well, let's talk about the two women who were killed. 40-year-old Kelly Loving, she was visiting Club Q on a weekend trip from Denver, where she lives. Tell us about her.
Yeah, the friends described Loving as a wonderful friend, as someone who helped convene and congregate folks within the LGBTQ community. And as you mentioned, she was visiting from Denver on a night out.
Like so many people, just going out on a regular night out, not expecting anything more than good times. And then finally, there's a young mother, 35-year-old Ashley Paugh. She was killed, and she leaves behind her husband and an 11-year-old daughter.
Yes. Her sister-in-law posted about her death and said, "My wish is that he, the shooter, could hear the screams of my niece crying for her mommy as her crying father tells her that her mommy is gone." These are all five of them, people with families and loved ones and friends who miss them tremendously and are trying to wrap their head around the senseless violence that took them away. And a lot of people I've talked to have expressed not only sadness, but anger at what they feel was the hatred that led to this attack. Police have not described the motives of the shooter yet, but many in the LGBTQ community here feel that it is obvious and unavoidable that when a queer club is targeted, there is a hate element there. And many of them look to the rhetoric around the country directing hatred towards the LGBTQ community, and particularly the trans community, particularly the drag community, and say that that cannot be lost in the conversation about what happened here. It's a factor in their minds and should not be ignored.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Rector, legal affairs reporter at the LA Times. He's in Colorado Springs covering Saturday's shooting at Club Q. Five people were killed and 18 wounded. A look at the Mars Rover space program and why these robots took on lives of their own.
No one says, "I'm really going to miss my old cell phone," right? what you're saying goodbye to is the camaraderie of coming together as a team to do this incredible stuff that's on the absolute limit of the human experience.
A new documentary about JPL scientists' mission to find out whether there is life on Mars and finding an unexpected connection to their robot colleagues. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Seven, six.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Two, main engine start, zero, and liftoff of the Delta rocket with Opportunity.
Nearly 20 years ago, NASA launched a twin pair of rovers to Mars. 6 months and tens of millions of miles later, they landed on the red planet to look for past signs of water and evidence of life.
To have positive confirmation of a safe landing.
We're seeing it on the LTP.
The mission was supposed to last just 3 months, but one of the rovers, Opportunity, far exceeded expectations and continued to roam the Martian desert, exploring craters and analyzing rocks for nearly 15 years. During that time, the NASA scientists at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena formed such a close bond and attachment to this rover that by the time the mission unexpectedly ended in 2018, it was almost as if they lost a family member.
I don't have to tell you guys, we get emotionally attached to these vehicles, right? You use a word like love advisedly, but we love these rovers.
It's actually crying there. Well, filmmaker Ryan White tells the story of this rover in a new documentary called Goodnight Oppie. It debuts tomorrow night on Amazon's Prime Video. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. And Doug Ellison is here, too. He's a JPL scientist who worked on the rover. Hi.
It's great to speak to you. How are you?
Well, it's great to have you. Okay. Well, Ryan, let's begin with you. A big part of why these scientists formed such an attachment to Opportunity is because she, they do refer to her as she, has a lot of human-like characteristics. Can you just describe what she and her sister look like?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they weren't designed by accident. They were designed very purposefully. And they have a face, they have eyes, they have wheels that act as their legs. They have a mechanical arm that can take measurements. And so they very much look like an adorable, lovable creature and are definitely anthropomorphized to a certain degree.
Doug, why were they designed that way to look like humans?
They were designed to be robotic mobile geologists, and so you want to have something that can trundle around to get the lay of the land. And the pairs of cameras that look like eyes, that's entirely by design, because it is by having pairs of eyes that humans can sense depth, we can sense the distance to things, and taking images with stereo cameras is exactly how we did that with our rovers. We take pairs of images with a left eye and a right eye, and that's how we kind of get the 3D lay of the land. And so you end up with, albeit a robot, but it is a cute robot. It is a kind of human scale robot. There is a cuteness to it. But it comes from a place of wanting to build a mobile field geologist.
They also have unique personalities, too. Or at least that's how you see them, as having different personalities. So it's kind of like how twins take on different characteristics. So Spirit is a little difficult, but Opportunity, Doug, I think you call her Little Miss Perfect.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, you wouldn't expect to go to like an IT store and buy two laptops and expect them to have personalities when you get them out of the box. But these are hand-built, almost very nearly one of a kind. And when they were being built, the vehicle that ended up being called Spirit would arrive at various tests first. And as one might expect, it would have trouble with those tests, and then they'd fix it, and eventually it would pass. And then along comes Opportunity a few weeks or months later and passes that test with flying colors. And that just carried to Mars somehow. So Spirit had to cover miles and miles and miles to make kind of amazing scientific discoveries, whereas Opportunity literally landed, opened her eyes, and there was incredible science 20 feet right in front of her.
Okay, well, let's play another clip from the movie. And in this one, two of the scientists featured in the film who worked on Opportunity, Kobe Boykins and Steve Squires, are talking about what they felt the moment she lifted off in 2003.
I have raised this child. That's sort of what it feels like. And now it's that child's moment to shine. But it was hard to say goodbye. I devoted 16 years of my life to these rovers. And then you put them on top of a rocket and you shoot them into space and you're never going to see them again.
And Doug, did you feel that way?
It's funny. I was an outsider looking in when these robots were being built and early on in the mission. And I think for the people who are a part of this project from the very beginning, I think there is almost this kind of I'm preparing my child for college kind of feel to the experience they went through. For those of us who joined the project later, I think it almost feels more like a sibling, like a colleague. These robots are getting better, they're doing more things, and our careers are doing the same, and so we're kind of working side by side. They're robotic colleagues, robotic envoys, rather than kind of a child we unleashed into the solar system.
And what did you do?
So my job was an engineering camera payload uplink lead. I was very fortunate to get to take several hundred pictures with some of the cameras on the Opportunity rover for the last 18 months of its mission.
And were you part of this project where she was programmed to take selfies of herself?
Yes. I will openly confess this was my dumb idea.
It was.
The rovers predate the phrase selfie, but that is exactly what we did. We took 17 images with the microscope turned around, and instead of looking at rocks right in front of it, it was looking at the rover right behind it. And it came out better than I think most people were expecting. It's low resolution, it's black and white, it's fuzzy, but it is the first time that any of us had seen the rover at that point for getting on for 16 years. And it was a pretty special moment.
Well, what did it look like? Or what did she look like?
So it's for those people who kind of were familiar with the rovers, it was like seeing an old friend. There were little features like you could see the tread on the front wheels at the front of the rover. You could see how dust had accumulated on the camera mast, but only in certain places because there's kind of tape that held wires in place and stuff like that. You could see the camera right at the top. You could see the cameras on top of the mast. You could see the antennas on the back of the rover. You could see the solar panels. And way off in the distance, you could see kind of a fuzzy horizon. It was really, really nice to see the rover from its own perspective. And I'm glad the scientists indulged us in taking the time to take a selfie.
Ryan, I want to digress just a little bit and talk about the filmmaking process using these images and using what we know Mars looks like. Because you, in the movie, you really animate what these two rovers are seeing and looking at. How did you create the sense that we were actually on Mars with these rovers?
So when we hatched this idea for the film, the motto for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is the home of the NASA's Mars missions, is Dare Mighty Things. And they are always trying to pull off the impossible. And when they failed, it's failed very publicly and in a very humiliating manner. But when they succeed, it's been these smashing successes that everyone told them was impossible. So from the beginning, we said, if we're going to make a film about this, we also need to swing for the bleachers. And because of people like Doug, we have hundreds of thousands of photographs of their journeys. Each robot has 9 cameras on her. So every day that she went through something that might be detailed in my film, we know exactly what it looks like. It's not a mystery anymore. And Doug could help supply Industrial Light and Magic, you know, George Lucas's brilliant company that brought this to life. Also with the data of like how much dust was in the air, where was the sun rising and setting? And so I think the biggest compliments we've been receiving are from people like Doug, who spend every day, you know, working on the surface of Mars through their proxies, through their avatars, these robots, and saying, like, we never expected it to look this real. And that is a real testament to the magic that Industrial Light and Magic can pull off.
And you're right that there are so many moments of drama. You're really on the edge of your seat when you're watching this movie of what's going to happen to these rovers. And I just want to play a moment from the film where you sent Opportunity down into a steep crater to explore.
The surface around the side of the crater wasn't as grippy as we'd hoped it was. And she apparently started sliding down the hill towards this giant boulder. But we have something called autonomy built into the rovers.
We allow the rover to think for itself because the rover knows more about the situation on Mars than we do.
So when Opportunity went down into the crater, she noticed that she was sliding too much downhill and stopped just centimeters from the tip of her solar panel. That short of crashing into this giant rock, which could have been mission ending for Opportunity. We all had heart attacks, but her autonomy saved us.
Oh my gosh. Doug, how many close calls were there like that?
So many. Some of our own doing. Sometimes we perhaps lacked a respect for, or perhaps more a familiarity of, the terrain we were going to be driving through. We very nearly got Opportunity completely stuck in a sand dune in literally the middle of nowhere. So many weird things that either were Mars is doing or are doing, or just the challenges of operating an increasingly decrepit rover. But that really is what kind of brings the team together. It's through those challenges that the team kind of proves itself and comes together. And as Ryan said, the JPL motto is dare mighty things. We just kept rolling with the punches and kept the rover going as long as we could.
So she spends 15 years on Mars and travels more than 25 miles across the Martian surface. And then she encounters her final challenge, if you will. What happened to her?
So we were about 5,100 days into our 90-day mission, and we got reports from our colleagues on one of the Mars orbiters called the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that takes daily weather images of the whole of Mars, amongst many other things. And they said there's a dust storm brewing kind of halfway around the planet. Looks like it could be a big one, but we'll keep you posted. And that little dust storm blew into a planet encircling dust storm in a little over a week. We went from having a rover that had all the solar power in the world, 600 watt hours, right? Enough to recharge a laptop six times over, loads of power. We could do anything we want. We could stay awake all day, we could drive, we could use the arm, we could take pictures, to you're done in about 10 days. We were not expecting something that harsh to happen that quickly. There was absolutely nothing we could have done. You know, it's just what Mars was going to throw at us. But on Sol 5111, it was the last time we ever heard from the rover. And it's been immortalized as the phrase, my battery is low and it's getting dark. But truthfully, that is, if you turn it into human terms, that is the last thing that Opportunity told us. We attempted to take a picture of the sun. That's what we would do every day to monitor how murky the atmosphere was. It was so murky, the rover couldn't even see the sun. And the last record we had of its battery was very, very close to being kind of flat, basically. And we had that last communications pass and hoped that maybe the rover might speak to us for another couple of days before essentially browning out. And then we tried for a little over 6 months to try and recover the rover, but sadly, we never heard from her again.
Oh, and it was sad. Everyone was in mourning almost, as we heard at the beginning. People were really, really torn up over this. I want to play another clip from the movie of Abigail Freeman, and she's a really incredible story. She has been with Opportunity literally since she was in high school. She visited JPL. as part of a science outreach at the beginning, and then she started working there.
And I just had the most vivid flashback to landing night, standing there as a 16-year-old in that same room and just realizing what I wanted to do with my life. But the journey was over. And it all just kind of hit me at once.
Yeah, she's a super emotional. Doug, were you also super emotional?
Yeah, I was there that last night with Abby and several dozen of those of us who were left on the project at the end there. And it's strange. Like, the rover went quiet very, very quickly because of how sudden that dust storm was, how savage that dust storm was. And it was many months of trying to get the vehicle back, trying lots of different strategies, talking to it through different radio antennas and trying everything we could possibly think of to try and essentially, you know, wake the rover back up again. But that last effort to talk to the rover was, it felt like a wake. It felt like we were saying goodbye to a family member. It really, really did. And the emotions were all out there, and Ryan had access to every second of that roller coaster that we went through. And I'm kind of glad that footage is now out there for people to see, because I think they can understand just how and why we seem to be in emotional turmoil over saying goodbye to what is essentially 400 pounds of metal. It's because it was through that robot that we came together as a team and did amazing things. You know, we're not actually saying goodbye to the robot, right? No one says, "I'm really going to miss my old cell phone," right? What you're saying goodbye to is the rewarding experience, the camaraderie of coming together as a team to do this incredible stuff that's on the absolute limit of the human experience, right? These robots were the first overland expeditions on another planet, and to see one of them come to an end was hard. It was really hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. And also because it was purposefully designed, as we talked about, to be human-like, to look like a human. Ryan, I'm wondering if that's also part of the purpose of the movie, is to make it more accessible that people who watch it, regular people who aren't scientists, can understand what's happening in the space program.
Absolutely. I mean, from the very beginning, it's rare as documentary filmmakers, you know, I've made a bunch of films. I've talked to you about a bunch of them on your program before, and almost all of them are very dark and heavy in subject matter. And that's usually, I think, our job as documentary filmmakers is holding up a mirror to society or the problems in the world. And it's very rare we have an opportunity to tell a story that's so hopeful and heartwarming. And this story is very sad at times, but I would say the overall tone is one of, you know, wonder and awe and discovery and these childlike sensibilities that we have when we're little kids. And then for whatever reason, as we become adults, we lose those sensibilities. And this was a group of people that was using those sensibilities every day in their work. And it was much more than just work to them. And I think that's the magic of what Doug's team brought to this mission.
What did we learn from Opportunity, Doug?
So much. We learned how to operate robots on the surface of another planet. We had never done this cut the cord and head out and go exploring kind of mission before. We learned how to do that. And we're still doing that to this day in basically the exact same way with the Curiosity rover and the Perseverance rover. We learned the importance of bringing the public along for the ride. We shared every single picture these rovers took almost in real time. The moment they reached the ground, they were there for the public so they could follow along and feel a part of this adventure. But most importantly, that the scientific legacy is one of really sealing the deal on this presumption we have that there was an ancient aquatic history to Mars. Mars today is almost airless. It is freezing cold. You would hate it. It sucks. But the evidence we found locked up in the mineralogy and the composition and the morphology of the rocks that Opportunity went around and explored started off with You know what? These rocks were formed in the presence of water, but probably pretty acidic water, probably more like battery acid, not the sort of place you'd want to raise your kids, right? But her longevity meant that we ended up going backwards in time to even further past in Mars's ancient geological history, to the point where we found evidence of rocks that were laid down in the presence of neutral pH water, water you might even have been able to drink. And that speaks to a habitable environment. You know, these robots were never really kitted out to find life, but what we did find was evidence on both sides of the planet of the sorts of places where on Earth we see life all the time.
I have to say, as hopeful and heartwarming as the movie is, it did fill me with a sense of dread at the end, because when I looked at that and I looked at what's happening here on Earth, I thought, is this a preview? If we don't get our act together when it comes to global climate change, is this what Earth is going to look like?
It's indisputable now at this point, and no one argues it, that the climate changed at some point on Mars, and there is that mystery question of when and why. And so, you know, if it's a way to take the politics out of that conversation, kind of the spoonful of sugar method, and have people really look at why our sister planet is what it is now and make us ask the questions, if we could eventually do that to ourselves, then I'm all for it, starting those conversations. But it's not, you know, what I set out to do. It's just the reality of what opportunity and spirit discovered on Mars, and it wouldn't have been doing them justice not to include those scientific conclusions.
And so, Doug, there are two rovers on Mars now, Curiosity and Perseverance. Do you like them as much?
So it's funny. I am now the planning team chief for the Curiosity rover. And hand on heart, my favorite rover was actually always Spirit.
You like the bad girls, huh?
She just always seemed feistier. Her adventure was always more rugged. Like, it just always felt like Spirit just had it a little tougher. And when her mission over, maybe she was just a little bit tired. But yeah, I've been with the Curiosity team for about 6 years, and we're a mobile geochemist, and we are picking apart that story that Ryan was talking about, the what happens to Mars. And we are literally, with the Curiosity rover, we are crossing through different layers of sedimentary geological record that tell us that story. We've almost done Opportunity's mission in more detail and backwards. But truthfully, Perseverance, I think, speaks to the fact that when it comes to robots, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square miles still to explore on Mars. But truthfully, it's time for us to take some pieces of Mars and bring them home. And so Perseverance's job, and it's doing it right now, is identifying, collecting samples that will eventually be returned back to Earth, so that instead of trying to squeeze laboratories into something the size of a shoebox, we can use the entire scientific community, the resources of laboratories around the world, to pick apart these samples and truly figure out, did Mars ever have life?
Mm, wow. Tantalizing. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Doug Ellison, one of the engineers at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. Ryan White, his new documentary is Goodnight Oppie, about the Mars Opportunity rover. It debuts tomorrow night on Amazon's Prime Video. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to help you with last-minute Thanksgiving dinner panic. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
All right. Our biggest food holiday of the year is almost here, and there will be, of course, plenty of pie. And as home cooks know very well, probably also plenty of hiccups, maybe even some tears along the way in our quest to impress with a masterful and perfect Thanksgiving spread. Well, good thing for us, we have a cooking pro on speed dial. She's here now with some pro tips and last minute hacks to help us out. Evan Kleinman, host KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
Tears. Let's hope not. Right.
I mean, really, you shouldn't cry over a meal. You can always just find a 24
hour milk.
Yeah. You can always just find a 24 hour deli and get a bunch of turkey sandwiches. I mean, I really think people need to lay down the burden of perfection and just get through it. And unless you're really mired in family expectation and you don't want to blow up your culinary traditions, really decide what you want and what you can let go of.
That is sound advice, not only for Thanksgiving, but for pretty much life. So
it's true. I mean, for example, I opted out of attending the gathering I've gone to for the past few years so I can spend the day with a cousin, and it's going to be just the two of us and two dogs just chilling, and I'm going to make plov, the Central Asian pilaf with meat.
Mm, that sounds so tasty. Well, if you are going the traditional route, there are a lot of steps, and I guess planning it out would alleviate some of the stress. So where should we be focusing right now as we're pretty much 2 days out?
Well, hopefully you have already done your shopping or you already have your lists. I like doing all my prep days in advance, all the aromatic veggies for all the recipes chopped and organized, herbs pulled and chopped, bird brined or rubbed, broth for the gravy if you're making your own, made from the neck and the giblets you pull out of the inside of the turkey. And I tend to make lists like a general who moves his men around on a board. You know, you can't plan for all the contingencies, but you can get a lot out of the way so you have more time if the unexpected happens.
Can you brine days in advance?
You should brine days in advance.
Okay.
Yes. And
if you
remember,
don't, are you in trouble?
No, because, you know, most commercial turkeys these days that you buy in a grocery store have been pre-brined. Just read the label. And if you see the word saline solution or salt in an ingredient list, it means it's already been brined.
Oh, so don't bother.
Yeah. I mean, it would be awful. You'd make it super salty.
What about making pies ahead of time?
I have made entire apple pies ahead of time up to baking it. Like, I've rolled out the dough, put it in the pan, filled it with my apples, put the second crust on, and put it in the freezer. And then I just bake it either the night before or the day of. You know, an apple pie takes at the most 60 to 75 minutes to bake. So you can actually put it in the oven when you take the turkey out, if oven space is at a premium, and it's going to make the house smell completely amazing. And because you froze the pie, the crust will be exceptional. But for pecan and pumpkin or sweet potato pies, they can all be made the day before. And if you're blind baking your crust 3 days before.
Okay, good. So that alleviates some of the stress. You asked your audience to submit questions, and we have some of our own. But what were some of the questions that you've never heard before? What were some of them that you received this year?
Well, I think one that really struck a lot of us was from an audience member named Jessica from Las Vegas. She's the primary cook for herself and her father. She's an herbivore. Dad is a carnivore who does not like poultry. It's just the two of them. So I told her to just make her dad a steak, a really great steak and a loaded baked potato, maybe some cream spinach, or a slab, like a steak of a rib roast, you know, a rib steak. Those are just really luxurious and delicious. Don't do anything out of your wheelhouse, but treat yourself well.
Okay, well, let's say you have not gone to the farmer's market this past weekend and you wanted to, but you just didn't, and you need to make some sides. That'll be good. What do you recommend?
Well, you know, not everybody goes to the farmer's market. And although, yes, it's wonderful, it's the ideal, you don't have to take on that burden. And I mean, I would try to avoid frozen or canned vegetables just because there are so many fresh, ready prepped vegetables at our grocery stores. Everything from aromatic vegetables of those, like at Trader Joe's, how they always have those containers of onion, celery, and carrots already chopped up, which you're going to need for your stuffing. Buy that. If you see a container of diced butternut squash, get that. I mean, you're going to do your zhuzh to it anyway. Mm-hmm. Just try and make decisions that will save your sanity.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, what about being dairy-free? So your producer, Jillian Ferguson, is going dairy-free for the first time, but she's worried about, well, not having butter in her mashed potatoes.
Yeah, her baby is, you know, has showed some allergies. So she's being very cautious. And she specifically asked me about mashed potatoes. And I told her to make a garlic confit, in other words, slowly cook garlic in olive oil, and then use the oil and the garlic in the mash. It's so good. And then you could use your favorite faux milk to loosen up the potatoes. Another idea is to make kolkanen, the Irish dish of kale and potatoes mashed together. But I would first braise the greens in sort of the Italian style with garlic and olive oil and a little bit of water. And then when they're really nice and tender, I would mix them into mashed potatoes and it'll be delicious.
Oh, that sounds good, even if you aren't a dairy-free person.
Exactly.
All right. Here's a question that I think a lot of people will want the answer to. What if you have overcooked the turkey?
Okay, so usually when you overcook the turkey, you are overcooking the breasts. It's really, really rare to overcook the whole thing so that the dark meat is dry. So if the breasts are dry, which happens to the best of us, it's happened to me, cut them off the bone and slice them and then bathe it in a warm or hot broth before serving. Just let it soak up a little bit of juice. You won't have that moment of presenting a whole turkey, but really, who cares?
I don't display the whole turkey anyway, because you're just going to cut it up.
I think the Norman Rockwell moment needs to die.
Okay, finally, since you are the queen of the pie, what if you burn your pie or if you undercook your pie?
Well, the easiest way to not burn your pie is if the top crust is pretty much ready or nearly ready, but the filling is nowhere near ready, as often happens with apples. Just cover the entire pie with foil. Don't just cover the edges. Cover the whole top. And then once you see that beautiful thickened juice of the apples start to leak out of the slits, take the foil off and let the pie finish. You know, I once took a pie out of the oven to serve and it was almost raw, like literally the bottom was totally raw. And then the filling inside hadn't thickened because it hadn't cooked long enough for the juices to boil. So what I did is I just turned it upside down into another pan, pie pan, a clean pie pan, so that the cooked top was on the bottom and the raw bottom was on the top. And I put it back in the oven and it was sort of like a cobbler. It was delicious. It looked, you know, kind of super rustic, but who cares?
I know if it tastes good, who cares?
Have ice cream on hand. And remember, every pie has someone who loves it, even if you are disappointed.
That is another good aphorism for life. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Evan Kleinman hosts KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear on KCRW on Saturdays at 10 and wherever you get your podcasts. And you can check out a video of her answering more audience questions and giving more of her valuable advice at KCRW Good Food. That's her Instagram handle. So go check it out. Also follow her at that Instagram handle. Evan, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Just enjoy yourselves.
All right. We hope that you enjoy yourself, whatever you're doing for the rest of the day. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.